Go.
Okay, good evening. I'm grateful to my nephew Ari for inviting me to offer this offer my musings on this on various issues tonight, and I'm grateful for everybody for coming and to Facebook for helping me make it into a into an event. This is the second event I've actually done. The first was my book launch, which actually also got, well, actually that got like 100 people, but all right. So it's all right. It's easier in Jerusalem than here. Certainly the parking is easier in Jerusalem than here. Okay. The truth of the matter is that the topic I chose, how and when halacha changes, could easily be transformed into a discussion of the question of how and when, how actually halacha is supposed to work. And it's, maybe that's the focus that I want to make here. We're in a period of tremendous turmoil in the West in general, and that has its impact upon the Orthodox community and upon the halachic community as well. And all kinds of extreme positions have been adopted on any number of issues. One of them was bruited about yesterday or today, earlier today in Yerushalayim at the Gay Pride Parade. And other things a little less, perhaps less dramatic. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So that as soon as people want to make changes, you get an equal opposite reaction that everybody's an epikiris and nothing can change and everything stays the same, and so on and so forth. So I would like to avoid the, extremes because, as I don't remember who said this, the extremes are logical, but they're also absurd. And try to get a handle on what are the factors that go into proper psak. How does it work? How has it worked historically? What are the issues? What are the elements which go into psak halacha, which perhaps we haven't paid attention to in all of the arguments that have been going on, at least for the last 100 years, regarding this institution and that institution. So I'd like to start on, and so that it, we're going to look at separate factors, which I hope will ultimately gel into a broader picture, but certainly each one deserves its deserves a discussion on its own. I'd like to begin with number one, and it's a passage from an article written by my teacher, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. He published it in 1987. However, to a significant degree, this paragraph is not only his credo academically. He repeated it at a recent conference in his honor at Ben Gurion University, in Be'er Sheva. But also, it tells us a lot about how halacha is supposed to work from the inside. So he writes as follows: if law is conceived of as religious law must be, as a revelation of the divine will, then any attempt to align will with human wants, any attempt to have reality control rather than to be itself controlled by the divine norm, is an act of blasphemy and is inconceivable to a God-fearing man. In other words, the nature of the religious gesture is Kabbalas Olmachu Shemayim, the acceptance of the yoke of heaven. Yes, we are in a covenant with God, but the normative part of that covenant is the fact that we defer to God. Or, as David Campbell sings in Joseph, Prince of Dreams, "You know better than I." Great song. If you're not familiar with it, go to YouTube. I highly recommend it. It's important to keep this in mind because there is a malmo. I would say a bonmo, but it's really not a bonmo. It's a malmo. That where there's a religious will, there's a rabbinic, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, which is the diametric opposite of this statement, which in fact is the point of departure for all halachic discussion. By the way, Professor David Schatz once said that another way to give that bon mot, you must have heard this before, is im tirtzu ein zu halacha. So that's point number one. As the Middle Ages was an age of faith among Jews no less than among Christians and Muslims, the unalignability, the non-adaptability, if you wish, of religious law as a premise which must underlie all our investigations and understanding of the history of halacha in the Middle Ages. Yet the okay, so then I'm going to come back to the second half of this paragraph in a little bit. Point of departure is, however, that the Torah doesn't belong to us to do with as we wish. We must adjust to the Torah. Now, that doesn't mean the Torah is a Procrustean bed. It doesn't mean that we're sitting in a, that we're sitting in a cage. It doesn't mean that nothing ever changes. That's absolutely, I mean, as Rishonim would say, hakhush makhish. Anybody who looks around knows very, very well that from left and from right, the Judaism that we practice doesn't look anything like that which took place in the time of the Talmud. Never mind earlier. This finds beautiful expression in a famous Gemara. Gemara in this tells a story how God, Moshe Rabbeinu, comes up to heaven and sees God is actually crocheting. He's crocheting, and nowadays girls don't crochet so much anymore. But God was crocheting, and he was crocheting the decorations onto the letters of the Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to him, "Why, you're nervous? This is what you have to do." Say, "What's this for?" He says, "Oh, there's going to be a person hundreds of years from now, named Akiva ben Yosef, and he is going to interpret every single one of these little doodads on every single letter." And Moshe Rabbeinu was totally intrigued by this statement, and he says, "I want to see him." So God says, "Listen, he's up in heaven anyway." So flash forward. And he brings him to Rabbi Akiva's Beis Medrash in Bnei Brak. By the way, where is Bnei Brak? The real Bnei Brak, not the fake Bnei Brak. The real Bnei Brak is underneath the Chiria, is underneath the large disposal landfill on Route 4, underneath something called Somit Misubin, the Misubin interchange, because Rabbi Akiva was... they were Misubin, according to Agada in Bnei Brak. The real Bnei Brak is somewhat north. The contemporary Bnei Brak is somewhat north of there. So brings him to his bed, to Rabbi Kiba's bed, and Rabbi Kiba's giving a shir, and Meshur Rabbeinu doesn't understand a word. Farshtay gornished. So Moshe Rabbeinu starts feeling very upset. He says, I go to the shir, I can't understand. You know, it was one of these rabbis who was brilliant, I didn't understand a word. So he's about to really lose it until finally one of the students asks Rabbi Akiva, "Rebbe, how do you know this is true?" Rabbi Akiva says, "Oh, this is halacha l'Moshe Misinai. This guy goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu." Moshe Rabbeinu felt a lot better and went back to God in his discussion. Meaning that the rabbis themselves were very much aware of the fact that things develop, things don't stay the same, things are not frozen in time. Nevertheless, the point of departure of any halachic discussion is that the Torah is divine, that the Torah is God's, that it's a privilege that's given to us to apply it. Even if you don't believe in God, and that's the point number two, all right, if you study Jewish law, you are demanded at least to give credit to poskim in different generations, scholars in different generations, that they did, and that they treated the Torah with deference and with reverence. That's a very important point, because there is a line of argument in contemporary academic studies which has begun to penetrate internal Orthodox discourse, according to which the rabbis also, they didn't really care, they just made frishmish whatever they wanted, they adapted things as they wish, they were a function of their times, they were a function of their prejudices, they approached the Torah like you would, as you would any other discipline, did what they want, and went further. What Professor Soloveitchik is saying, and I think from a historiographical point of view, is the only way to go, that you have to assume the integrity of a religious figure of the past, that he believes in what he believes. It is disrespectful in the extreme, not to mention a lie, to say otherwise. Okay? Now, that the segue, actually, to the question of what modality is Psak Halacha supposed to be undertaken. So, towards this end, here we go from son to father. Towards this end, I will, it's important to, in number two, I'd like to call your attention to a Gemara in Bava Metzia, which Mori Verabi, the Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, frequently invoked. The Gemara says as follows: Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Mai Dichtiv Mi Aisha Chacham V'Yavenet Zot V'Asher Diber Pi Hashem Elav V'Yageda Me Avdah Haaretz. Who is the person who is wise and understands this, and to whom God has spoken, and so that he should tell us why was the land destroyed? What led to the destruction of the temple, to the conquest of land of Israel by the Babylonians in 586? Davar zeh, says the Gemara, Amru chachamim velo pirshuhu. The sages said, and they didn't explain it, velo pirshuhu. And the prophets themselves asserted it, and they didn't explain exactly what was the reason that the land was destroyed. It required God's secondary revelation itself to make this point clear. Shenemar vayomer Hashem alozvam et Torati asher natati lifnehem, for they have abandoned my Torah which I have given before them. Now, if I'd stopped here, be fine. Absolutely no problem, because it's clear that the reason why, all the prophets say the same thing, that the reason why the temple was destroyed in the first time around was because of the abandonment or the lack of performance or observance of the major commandments, or most of the commandments, by the Jews, whether it was in the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. Generally, Chazal highlight the fact that this actually comes out from the book of Jeremiah also, that they really were especially guilty of the big three, whether it was foreign worship, Avodah Zarah, Shvichas Damim, murder, or Gilui Arayos, sexual impropriety. So good. So in fact, if you look at the covenantal passages in Chumash, you see exactly right. You behave, you get to stay. Hey, you don't get to stay. It's interesting in that regard. The Rav also used to point out that the relationship of the Jews to the land of Israel is a dual one. I'm going to rephrase what he said in a little bit more contemporary mode. The ownership of the land of Israel by the Jewish people is absolute and inviolate and inviolable and eternal. That's the point that Rashi tries to make in his first comment on Chumash. That, you know, the whole reason for the story of Bereshis is that God has the right to give lands to whomever he wishes, and if he gave it to us, then that's where it is. Nevertheless, there are two elements required to be able, I don't know if it's true, still true, it used to be true in New York, I don't know if it's still true. It used to be you could have title, but you also have right of residence or certificate of occupancy. Is that still true? It used to be. Anyway, alright? So, the same thing is true in terms of Eretz Yisrael. The title to the land belongs to the land of Israel. Certificate of ownership, certificate of occupancy is dependent upon good behavior. Or as Rashi says at the in the middle of in Kedoshim, Ein Eretz Yisrael sovelet over Aveira, that the land of Israel does not tolerate those who do not observe the Torah, those who are. So similarly, you know, so this statement up until this point is fine. You know, they didn't behave, they didn't lose title to the land, but they lost, but their certificate of occupancy was suspended for a period of 70 days. And then, the Gemara comes in and throws a curveball. That sucks her in first place, I gotta put that in. I'm Rav Yehuda, I'm a Rav, says Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, Shelo Birchu Batorah Tchila. Their abandonment of the Torah found expression in the fact that he didn't say Birkas HaTorah before. Which should leave all of us with our jaws dropped. What? That's it? That's it? What are you talking about? What kind of crazy thing is that? What possible sin could be involved? All right, fine. You didn't say Birkas HaTorah. Good. You know what? If I forgot to make a before the Gemara says in brachas, if I forgot to make a bracha before I ate an apple. So, okay, so you know what? Next time I eat an apple, I'll make sure to break a bracha. How terrible is this? And nevertheless, the Gemara says that the Alazvama Torati is affected by not making Birkas HaTorah, or flip it the other way, one could actually study Torah and fulfill the mitzvahs, but if you don't make Birkas HaTorah, if you don't recite Birkas HaTorah before that, that undermines the credibility, the legitimacy, and the validity of what you're doing. So what kind of thing is this? I'd like to suggest the following, and I think this is what, the Rav hinted at one of the, in one of the, one of his, Yahrzeit drushes, is Torah. You can look at it in two separate ways. It is material, inspirational material to guide our lives, which is part of the heritage of the Jewish people and also part of the world heritage. But it is nothing more than a text or a series of texts or a library which is a text like any other text. And in fact, if you listen to many different, if you listen to the way people speak, oh, we are going, please give out the texts that we're going to study today. Yes, in a seminar or in a shir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to study text, I invite you, I really do, it's a genuine invitation, to come to my seminar, Bar Ilan, and we will study the Divine Comedy of my favorite author, Dante Alighieri, and compare it to the Hebrew knockoff known as the Tophet Ba'eden, which is written by a younger contemporary of Dante, Manuelo of Rome. That's studying text. It's fun. It's wonderful. I'm in love with Dante. This has nothing to do with saying anything bad about Dante. Okay? That's text. There is all the difference in the world between text and Torah. When you study text, you take it apart, you examine it, you feel good, and then you go out for dinner. When you study Torah, what's demanded is not just proper study. It means invoking a modality of study which is sacred. It means invoking the name of God and transforming the gesture of study into a religious act, into an encounter with God. Whether that encounter is quiet, like the encounter between Elijah and God at Har Chorev in a still small voice, or whether it has special effects like in the Ten Commandments, 1956 version, then that's a different story. But it's an encounter with God, which means, by definition, your attitude towards what you study and the degree to which you feel, and to the reverence what you feel towards what you study and towards the Gnosei HaTorah is going to determine your attitude there too. That, in other words, the difference between al shelo berchu b'Torah tchila means what were they doing? They were treating the Torah like any other book, like any constitution? Or were they treating it as the word of God to which they were duty bound to upheld? That is the issue. And indeed, it is precisely that which is, that also, to connect two with number one, it is exactly that which is the point of departure that we should assume about ourselves, but not also about Poskim in the past. I'm going to skip three. Now, that awareness that you're dealing with God's law has a formative impact upon Poskim before they even start. Because again, you're not just starting. You don't have to give me a lecture by the seat of your pants, which many of my colleagues do, and I would even confess, sometimes, you know, not 100% prepared. But you can't do that with Torah. Number four. Amar Rabbi Abba, Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav. Mai dichtiv ki rabim chalalim hipila. When the pasuk says, for it led to many people to die, Zet Talmid shelo higia lahora umora. This is a student who has not finished his studies, not finished his training, not finished his stage, not finished his apprenticeship, and nevertheless has the arrogance to go and to Paskin Shilas. Vatsumim kol harugeha, and even greater are the numbers of those who have been killed, the Talmud shigila hora, the Einomora. This is the student who actually is qualified, is fully qualified, and abstains. What you have hiding behind this statement is two words. Yirat hora'ah, fear of paskening, which is a permanent moment. It's almost it's a natural moment in the history of halacha, because if you're dealing with God, if you're dealing with God's law, you're going to be very hesitant before you render any decision whatsoever. Because as opposed to doctors can, if they give the wrong prescription, it's true. I mean, God forbid something terrible could happen. But if the person dies, that's the end of their suffering. If you paskin wrong for picking their neshama in your hands, you might be blaspheming implicitly or explicitly. That awareness that that what you have here is so sensitive that the responsibility that the Torah gives scholars to paskin it, to rule, is so intense, can actually infuse the uninformed, the untrained, to rush in where angels fear to tread. You know what the first part of that is, right? Yes. And more importantly, so that's a horrible thing, says the Gemara. But even more nefarious, even more destructive, even more deadly, are the people who brook false modesty, who have the qualifications and refuse to stick their neck out because I don't want to get involved. That's the greater sin. So that the action of the scholar, the action of the act of deciding halachic issues has to weigh between one sense of insecurity, you know what happens when you move to Israel, become illiterate in two languages. Lack of qualification on the one hand, versus the realization that in fact you have to. On the one hand, who am I? On the other hand, the makom shein anashim ishtadel yodish. You have an obligation to get out there if nobody else is there. But it's all done with caution and reverence. And that's how you mediate the Scylla and Charybdis of the two sides of this equation that are paved here by the Gemara. And if you read, you don't find this in codes, but if you read Tshuvas, if you read Responsa, or every author of Responsa who's worth his salt through the generations, starts off by saying, who am I to do this? I'm really nervous. Even Reb Moshe Zatzal, in the introduction to the Igros Moshe, has a long introduction in which, among other things, he says, he addresses this Gemara. He says, who am I to paskin? And yet I have to paskin, because there's nobody else. And he goes back and forth and back and forth. And he was a person who knew who he was, knew what his talents were, and knew that he had to. Nevertheless, that those butterflies in his stomach never really went away. Ultimately, and that's what the Gemara says, obligation has to be determinative, and as a result, you have to overcome your inhibitions if you're qualified. But you don't go rushing in before you do the cheshbon nefesh to deal with it. In addition, I would add that behind number four is another motif which runs through all of Responsa literature, especially Ashkenazi Responsa literature, but not just. Collegiality. Especially on path-breaking, daring Piskei Halacha, nobody wants to do it on their own because too much depends on it, whether it's a matter of being Matzah and Aguna, whether it's a question of Geiris, whether it's a question of whatever the issue. So the idea of a collegiality, of mutual consultation, is built into the halachic framework in large degree because of the sense of great responsibility which is at the base of this Gemara and other statements like it. Okay. So 1, 2, 3, and 4 are the modality, the atmosphere, the attitude that a person has that halacha works within. It is not treated happenstance. It's treated as an act by which one interprets God's will. And the God awareness is not lip service. We forget something. We live in a secular world. You know, if God's in shul during the week, that's already something. We don't invoke God during the week, generally. Certainly not in our daily interactions. That's not the way the Jews lived until before the even up to World War II. Jewish life is all inclusive. That's why this Choshen Mishpat. Everything is affected by the Torah, and what God has to say about God awareness is in fact statement of the Ramah. The most important principle, says the Ramah, is Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. That awareness should be translated as being very, very tangible for poskim through the ages. You know, maybe because we have an intimacy problem, I don't know. But one has to assume, and it comes, and poskim express this, that in fact, it's with that attitude that they address whatever issue is at hand. Okay. Nevertheless, halacha is a dynamic. Halacha is a dynamic discipline. We believe, or tradition has always believed, that the Torah, that the Gemara and its attendant literature, is a closed system with its own rules, with its own codes of interpretation. And in fact, the best proof of the fact that in fact that is true, that it doesn't change from generation to generation in that regard, is the fact that is the reality that generation after generation under this generation said. Try to read Chaucer without a translation. Try to read Shakespeare without a translation, without the little notes in the Mentor edition or the Signet edition. But we can carry on a transgenerational discussion with people who lived in the 12th and the 10th and the 9th and the 16th century as if they were there. That's a very significant consideration. So what do we do? How does halacha work? It's basically a question of, and I think here, despite the fact he was very often ideologically driven in a lot of these letters, the Chazon Ish in the first volume of his collected letters, letter number 36, says that when you pass in a shaila, it's basically two parts. For part one is the easy part or the fun part, and part two is the hard part. The easy part is you do your research. You look up all the gemaras, you think about all the possibilities, and then you gotta apply it to the reality in front of you. Now that model is exactly the way poskim assume halacha works. You take a self-contained legal system, and then you have to figure out how it interacts with a changeable protean reality. Now that, in fact, can be changes in that reality can in fact be responsible for change in halacha. So yes, halacha doesn't change because the system is a closed system. However, reality changes and then can very easily elicit different responses from the halachic system. Okay, that's where change actually lies. As long as those changes don't come from without the Gemara and the ironclad rules of interpretation. I'll give you an example. Number 5, one of my favorite. In fact, I bathe this. This is really one of my favorite examples. Happens to be that this goes lechumra, but it doesn't have to. Just because it got to do with Italy. Because I wrote my doctorate about this guy and I published an article that everybody likes about it. So I like to bring this example. In 1470, the leading rabbi Italy of the among the Italiani, whose name was Yehuda Messalion. Yehuda Messalion was the Rosh Hashiva of Ancona, and he was involved in rhetoric. He's the first person to publish a Hebrew book in his lifetime. The book was to prove that the Bible, in its from a literary point of view, aligns itself, it fits the rules of rhetoric that were laid down by Cicero and Quintilian. Now, wasn't a bestseller then. It's probably not going to be a bestseller today either. The book is called Nofet Sufim. Actually, a funny story about this. There used to be a Sfarim store in Geula, for those of on the know, in Geula, Reshit Chochma. And the book was organized alphabetically, and I was, what do you do in a book like in a store like that? You go like this. So at one stage, and once I was there, and I was going through the nuns, and I found that there were two books called Nofet Sufim. One was an early edition of this book on rhetoric, showing the Bible Quintilian and Cicero jibe. And the other one was a book of Chassidische Meiselach by Rebbe, and it was called Neufes Sufim, and both of them were together. And I asked the guy, do you know what's in this book? He says, no, it's the Neufes Sufim. No, I said, but anyway, you never know what you can find in a bookstore. In any event, it's clear that he didn't read what he was carrying. In any event, so Messer Leon was also a doctor. And Messer Leon, at that point in history, Jews were not allowed to go to medical school, even though the two best medical schools in Europe were in Italy, in Salerno and Bologna. But he was a very well-known doctor, and there was a tremendous demand for Jewish, especially among the Italian nobility, because you could always depend on Jewish doctors not to poison you. You could not depend on Christian doctors not to poison you for all kinds of political reasons. But Jews were always dependent upon the good graces of the Christians, so that actually guaranteed good behavior. Not that the Jews would want to poison anybody anyways, but in any case. So he was a very prominent doctor. He had many students, but he did not have the right to give out MD degrees. The Holy Roman Emperor gave him that right in 1469, and as a result knighted him. That's why he's Messer Leon. And said, you can now wear the kappa as a sign of the fact that you've reached this madrega, that you can give out MDs. So what's this kappa? I'm sorry, I forgot to bring a picture. The kappa is not an academic gown the way that we know them. That's called the kappa clausa. This was a kappa manicata. It was a robe. It looked something like a poncho, which clearly was something derived from what bishops wore. But Messer Leon was very gehalten von sich. He was very excited about this. And apparently, he was living in Bologna, and one day he walked into shul wearing this thing, and his balabatim were less than thrilled to see that this is what the Rebbe is wearing. And throwing chairs and screaming and yelling and cursing the way that only Italians know how to do. And there was a whole balagan. So at that point, he wasn't sure what to do. One of his friends, whose name was Shmuel Damodena, said, you know what, my teacher, who lives in Mantova, might be able to help you. His name is Rabbi Yosef Kolon Traboto, Maharik, and he is considered to be one of the greatest poskim alive today. In fact, in his generation, after the death of the Truma Sedesh in 1460, he in fact was considered the greatest posek in the world of Ashkenaz. Anyway, ask him. So we did. Now, you would expect, if you're going to send a question like this to Borough Park, that the answer you're going to get is no. Right? Gosh. It's not the answer they got. Marik sent back a letter, which ended up being normative. Of course, it's quoted by Shulchan Aruch, it's quoted by the Ramah, and he writes as follows. Number 5. L'aniyut da'ati nira. Seems to me, the davar pashut de lo osa mishum chok, there are two dinim, there are two aspects, or two component parts to the prohibition against imitating non-Jews. It says, you don't have to go far to find that. Ha'echad, one, hu adavar asher ein ta'amo nigle k'de mashma lashon chok. He says, it's a something which you do which is bizarre, it's not rational. The same way we understand chukim lahavdil among Jews. Chukim are things that we don't know what the reason is, right? And why is that forbidden? Dekevan shuose davar mishuna asher ein botam nigla ela shein no agim kein as nira vada kinim shachachareihem. Clearly, if a person adopts an irrational, non-Jewish action, it is clear he does it because he wants to be like them. Because otherwise, why would you do that? Included in this section are all kinds of ritual things and religious actions and so on and so forth, but not only. But these are things which are uniquely, quintessentially non-Jewish. If you do them, it is because you want to look like a non-Jew, or you want to be accepted, you want to pass, whatever the case might be. What's the second criterion? V'inyana sheni, asor mishum hachukos ha'agoyim, lefi anizker laniyadati, hu adavar asher yesh bo shayach bo nidnus pritzat geder atzniut v'anava yinagu bo hagoyim gam zeh osur. Anything which smacks of arrogance. Tznius, by the way, does not mean how short your sleeves are or your skirt. Tznius here means being showy, being ostentatious, being arrogant, which, if you consider the way that Renaissance Italian non-Jews used to act if you think about the Medici and the Bardi and the Peruzzi and the various parts of the various residents of the papal palaces. I mean, I'm not going to mention the Borgia, which would take us in a whole other direction. You get a sense of what we're talking about. He said that's also usher, because that's quintessentially goyish. It's the exact opposite of how Jews are supposed to comport themselves. The Af Gam Zot, he says, and even then he says, Nira Dahainu Davka Kishuosa Kedeli Lamut Lahem Velo Litoelet Yidua. And even then, it's only when you do it in a uniquely non-Jewish fashion. So basically, the two go together. Actions which betoken a desire to assimilate, betoken a desire to pass, betoken a desire to be like non-Jews, then, Bechukoteim Lo Telechu. So therefore, if you have your Vietnamese table at a wedding or the smorgasbord, it might be very shit and it might be too much, but it's also probably achila gasa, but it doesn't make it into bechukoteihem lo teilechu. And later on, he says, as a result, his conclusion later on in the tshuva is, therefore, Jews and non-Jews do not have to dress differently. There is no advantage in dressing differently, because dress is okay. Now that is in 1469-70. What can you derive from that statement? You can derive from that statement the fact that in light of the fact that there is this assimilationist undertone or principle which underlies the prohibition against imitating the non-Jews, that Myrie Cohen was clearly convinced that his Jews were living in a self-contained Jewish world and there was no threat from the outside. Ironically, cultural and religious isolation allows for cultural openness. Okay. In fact, the Ramah Paskins precisely according to the rules laid down here by Myrie Cohen. Next page. Fast forward 400 years or so. This is a tshuva of a Polish posek, Harav Avram Zev Wolf Frankel, and he had to address the question of do Jews have to dress differently or not? Okay. And he writes as follows. V'im leheter samchu haTorah. There are those who allow this to occur. Mikol shekein leyisir b'makom sheroim chachmei ador shekol pinos hadatz toli b'zeh. ובמש יסקרו לעקום תהרס הדת כאשר בעבונתנו רבים ראינו האנשים אשר לבשו מלבושי נוחרים פרקועו לתורה ויראם מעל צווארם אמרו לאל סור ממנו ודס דרכיו לא חפצנו. He says, I can't say the Jews should dress like everybody else, because the people who, in fact, are advocating adopting European dress are the same people who are advocating assimilation and abandonment of the Torah. And so on. He says, if Ma'ari Kolam was alive, he would have answered this too. Now, this happens a lot. Well, you know what, there's that had to, but, you know, if he were alive today, he would have retracted it. You're familiar with the famous Slifkin controversies, of this, that, and the other thing about the age of the world and about the dinosaurs and this, that. So Rabbi Slifkin, who actually is a student of mine, published an article in Chakira, I think it is, in which the name of the article is They Could Say It, We Can't. In which a certain major halachic authority who lived in Meir Sharim and thought he was poskening for Meir Sharim and ended up poskening for the whole world, we won't mention any names, said that all of the various opinions that were given by various thinkers in the past, which would accommodate science and history. In contemporary discourse, as far as things in Chazal are concerned, they can say it, we can't. We have to take everything literally. So that is an argument. But if you think about this for a minute, here it works. Because what happened? The law didn't change. The law is that if you're imitating the non-Jewish world in order to pass, it's usher. If you're not, it's fine. What was going on in the 19th century in Poland? Maskilim were put with the active encouragement of the Tsarist government, were pushing for the abandonment, especially under Nicholas I, were pushing for the abandonment of traditional Jewish garb in order to encourage first the assimilation and then the apostasy of the Jewish population. So the circumstances had changed. So similarly, the application of the rules changed. The rules didn't change. The application changed because of the circumstance. Now here, it works l'chumra. It can easily work l'kula as well, and we will come back to that. Yes?
So I was wondering, from the first passage you showed us, this seems very similar to a lot of whoever some of ancient branches opposition
to the succeeding in terms of
just the greatest
thing of
Christian
scientists.
They're trying on the same idea.
No, because it's a similar idea. Except that the Rav saw the yes and no. The question was whether the Rav's opposition to mixing was part of a similar kind of sense. Yes, in the 40s and 50s there was this idea, and by the way, it's true of Reform in the 19th century as well, that Jewish prayer is not decorous sufficiently. Listen, when they used to spit at Elena, well, I think I can understand that. But that therefore we should adapt some of the mores of the, in Germany, the Lutheran church, quiet and order and so on, and mixed seating. And in fact, it was in the mid-20th century that the American Council of Churches ran a campaign, the family that prays together stays together, which in fact the conservative reform movements took very, very literally. So to that degree, that's true. There's something deeper than that, however. If you read the Rav's essays on the issue, the issue is the question of the nature of Jewish prayer, the nature that's actually relevant to today. The question of gender identity, of gender differentiation within halacha. There's a much broader tableau against which it should be understood. So you're part right, but there's, I think it's a bigger issue as well. Yeah.
Isn't that ironic? Like when you finished up the part with the Mari, was that ironic? The Jewish community isolation fostered this,
cultural openness.
Right.
I mean, they were dancing and hunting and this Italian Jews knew how to live.
Right. And
laissez les bon temps rouler.
You don't think that potentially
That's French.
A sense of confidence that he felt because of isolation like that. It's not actually ironic, but it is.
No, ironic. It's ironic in the sense that it's sort of like, it might be counterintuitive. You're right. It was a sense of confidence towards the outside
he
world.
Played the balance.
Okay. And in fact, I will, in fact, you know what, so I'm going to advance what I was going to say a little later. It is my opinion, just as a participant and also as a spectator, that a large degree of the fact that things like sneas and separation and segregation, stuff like that, play such a role in contemporary Orthodox society is because of an accurate perception that Western society is dissolving. With everything in regard to that. In other words, I think intuitively already, and this is something Yaakov Katz talked about, the Jewish your Jewish ritual instinct, that there is this sort of implicit perception or intuitive perception that the rest of the world is going to hell in a handbasket. So we have to sort of batten down the hatches and fortify ourselves inside. Now, I don't think that works in 2016. Because the internet and nobody can isolate anything. It's not the liaison of the Chassam Sofer where you can say, you know, I'm just gonna withdraw into the ghetto. Doesn't work anymore. This trick was tried in a number of places in Lakewood and in Geula, where a guy goes with his laptop and his router search function going in house after house after house after house. The house has a router and clearly has a connection to the internet. So that kind of self segregation doesn't work anymore. But I think, on the other hand, that there is a sense of dissolution on the outside world, so therefore we have to batten down the hatches. I think it's overstated. I think it's overdone, and I think it can be counter. I think personally, I think it's counter. It's counterproductive. Thank you, Frida. It's counterproductive. Nevertheless, the dynamic, I think, is definitely true. Yeah. Okay, it wasn't this time. It's 200 years later. It was after the ghetto went out. It's late 18th, early 19th century. And you're right, because one of the great tragedies of Italian Jewry, and to this day we don't know why, is that when the ghetto came down, everything just went.
I was making a different point, that the reason why the robbers were complaining is because this was accepted, observant practice.
Correct. Okay, correct. Okay, and it's not for nothing that I specialize in the Renaissance and Baroque. And I know how the story ends, as opposed to, you know, read the paper, you have no idea what's going to happen. Okay, which leads up, so number five, I've tried to show you that, in fact, that you had, that's the interaction of a self-contained, organic, and integrated halacha, or tradition, which interacts with a protean and changeable reality, and that's where the action and change happens. Those things cannot, however, alter the fundamental principles of Jewish law. They can't undo psukim. They can't undo open gemaras, and, as we'll see in a second, they can't undo, at least not easily, the consensus of the generations, which leads me to number six. In June of 1975, here I'm coming back actually a little bit to an essay that I published on Gil Student's Ahir Hurim blog as part of the Masora thing. It was actually, this essay I'm very proud of because it was picked up by Mosaic. In 1975, there was a very uncomfortable confrontation of sorts between the late Rabbi Emanuel Rachman and the Rav. Rabbi Rachman already then was very worried about the state and the exposure and the vulnerability of women to extortion by husbands who refused to give a get. And in this, he was absolutely right. I don't think he ever imagined it would get as bad as it has sometimes gotten. And he argued that as a result, that at least the halachic presumption that a woman will settle for anybody which prevents sometimes a court from ordering a get, should no longer be imposed because it is a result of the times in which it was uttered. That was the statement that he made. Ironically, a student of mine, Dr. Eliza Bazak, wrote a doctorate on this issue of Tavlamet of Tandu Miles of Alamalu, and she found that in the last 500 years that this argument has only been invoked in order to for the benefit of the woman, or to show that it shouldn't be invoked at all. So he was sort of like running through I don't think he realized he was running through an open door. But what got the Rav's ire at the time, and the Rav at a convocation of the Rabbinic alumni of Reitz, dedicated an entire very uncharacteristically sharp speech against the very idea that one can dismiss anything that Chazal say just because on the basis of the fact that it is time limited. This passage is typical. I think it's perhaps the money quote. That's an expression? The money quote? Okay. The money quote. I learned that from Rabbi Glickman, but I wasn't sure I got it right. Okay. What does Kabbalas Ol Malchut Shamayim require of the Lomed HaTorah? So Rabbi previously had said, when you part of the action of Talmud Torah is in fact to pursue it in a modality of spirituality, God awareness, and humility, which means that you a priori commit to the Torah on its own terms. What does Kabbalas Ol Malchut Shamayim require of the Lomed HaTorah? The person who studies Torah, first we must pursue the truth and nothing else but the truth. First of all, there's no shading things, there's no marketing, you follow things where they lead you. However, the truth in Talmud Torah can only be achieved through singular halachic Torah thinking and Torah understanding. Now this line has been misunderstood. What the Rav, I believe, means is that there are certain methodological rules by which the Torah has been studied and applied for the past 2,000 years, which run all the way back, at least as far as documentation is concerned, from the Sofrim down to the latest poskim. Methodological unity, which allows for generations to talk to each other. The truth is attained from within, in accordance with the methodology given to Moses and passed on from generation to generation. The truth can only be decided through joining the ranks of the Chachmei HaMasorah, a much abused word. It is ridiculous to say I've discovered something of which the Rashba didn't know, the Ketzos didn't know, the Vilna Gaon had no knowledge. I've discovered an approach to the interpretation of Torah which is completely new. It's ridiculous. Now the Rav didn't mean, he couldn't have meant, that there are no different schools within the broader rules of interpretation. Brisk doesn't fit what Sfardim do, and what Tosfos did was not precisely what the Rashba did. But these are variations on themes. These are subsections of a broader pattern. One must join the ranks of the Chachmei HaMasorah, Chazal, Rishonim, Gedolei Achronim, and must not, now here comes the money quote, and must not try to rationalize from without the Chukei HaTorah, and must not judge the Chukim and Mishpatim in terms of the secular system of values. Such an attempt, be it historicism, be it psychologism, be it utilitarianism, undermines the very foundations of Torah Masorah, and it leads eventually to the most tragic consequences of assimilationism and nihilism, no matter how good the original intentions are of the person who suggested it. What the Rav is driving at is this. Either the Torah has its own integrity and is unconditionally valid, or it isn't. If it is not, if it is divine, it must by definition be unconditionally valid. To evaluate and to predicate the mitzvos of the Torah upon whether they are helpful, or to say that they are simply the reflection of a bygone age, or to argue that Chazal were simply reflecting who they were or their prejudices, or anything of that sort, makes the Torah contingent on man. Rather than man accepting the mitzvos from God, it makes God work for man. And ultimately leads to the dissolution of the Torah based on passing fancies in culture and so on. Now, obviously every single person lives in their time. And they are affected by their times. That's That's understood. But any posek worth his salt will try to transcend his prejudices in an honest attempt to understand what the words mean and where the words are leading to. That they are valid on their own. The minute that you say, no, the Torah has to work for me, you have basically eviscerated the Torah. And it's true. At that point, all the Torah becomes is a Jewish decoration on another person's culture. Chernyakhovsky, who's not known for his piety, has a poem called El Nochach Pesel Apollo, coming to the the statue of Apollo. And he was in love with Apollo. He loved everything Greek. He's also married to a Shiksev. And in the poem, he bemoans the fact that the rabbis don't like aesthetics, and he'd like to go back to the original, to the glory of Greece and bring it to Israel and so on. He says that they took the beauty of Apollo and they put tvayasruhu birtsuot shel tefillin, and they bound him by with tefillin straps. Okay, so that's his point. My argument is, I think you should invert the image. It's just as he thought it was wrong to put tefillin on Apollo. I think it's also wrong to put a tefillin on Apollo. You can't put tefillin on Apollo and say now it's Jewish. And it's that kind of argument that the Rav is in vain, because it undermines the integrity of Torah. The difference between orthodoxy at the end of the day and every other movement is precisely on this point. Is Judaism a decoration on another culture's legitimate, credible, responsible set of values, or does it own integrity and interact with that on its own terms? That's the issue. And that is where the line runs. The minute that one adopts entirely, uncritically, another set of values and says, now I'm going to make this Jewish, it can be a Jewish thing you're doing. It is no longer tradition. It is no longer orthodoxy. It is no longer a halacha that can be recognizable by anybody. Yes? Multiple wives?
No.
Okay. I will tell you the background. First of all, because the Jewish ideal was always monogamous. The degree of polygamy was always relatively small, even in Arab countries. Would you like to know why we had a prohibition in the first place? One of the oddities one of the odd points is, if you look at responsa from Germany, from the time of Rainer Gershom, who started this whole thing, right? You don't find any cases of people having more than one wife. So what was bothering him? This he had to make an issue of. So there were those who argued that the late Professor Zev Falk argued the reason is because the Christians were arguing that the Jews are they're far too lusty, too carnal, and therefore this could be. That's not the reason. The real reason was discovered by an older colleague of mine, Professor Avram Grossman. It seems that in the 11th century, the 10th century, 11th century, the Jews had a lock on international trade, because Christians couldn't go to Muslim countries. To Muslim countries and vice versa. The only ones who could pass the lines were Jews. So what would happen is that, I'm being overly superficial, but for our purposes it's enough. Julie's heard this already. What would happen is that, if say you have a business in Mainz. So what do? You set your wife up to run the business with the children in Mainz. And you go set up, a branch in Damascus, in Cairo, in Alexandria, in Famagusta, in Samarkand, wherever it is. And you live, but you don't go, it's not where people can commute from Israel to America. You go 6 months, a year, whatever. And while you're there, boys will be boys. So apparently, they would marry local girls. How do we know that? Because there's a takana of the Rambam. The Rambam passed the takana in Cairo. in which he says that any Nochri, means a non-resident Jew, doesn't mean a goy, any Nochri that wants to marry a Jewish, local Jewish girl, has got to send a get to any wife he's got somewhere else. So you see that this was an issue. But what would happen? Well, what would happen is, so Chaim Shmuel comes from Mainz, and he lives in Cairo for X number of years. He goes home. He doesn't tell Elke Mishka Sarivka there at Dorton in Mainz that he's got another family. And finally he retires, and he sends, Chaim Yankel, the son, to go take over the business. He didn't tell him anything. What could happen? Nimtza'ach, no se asachosa. It could be that a person would marry a sibling or a half-sibling. That was the background to prevent. So Rabbeinu Gershom says, this has got to stop. So you can only have one wife, period. You want this one, keep this one. You want that one, keep that one. But one wife is all. So that's where it comes from. It comes from a serious concern with the implications of the fact that Jews had the right, had the opportunity to marry more than one wife. Yeah. Aristotle had no influence on. I think I can say this with no hesitation. Despite the Rambam's Aristotelianism, his Aristotelianism had absolute attack on his period. The only place maybe is the Rambam thought that you shouldn't write the names of angels on the front part of a mezuzah because he thought it was a superstition. It's got nothing to do with halacha. That's all got to do with Hashkafa. You want to argue more Nevuchim? We can argue more Nevuchim all day long. There is absolutely no impact of Aristotelian philosophy on the way he learned Halacha at all. And if, interestingly, people looked for him. I mean, those who opposed him were looking for things. That was never raised against him. He maintained that compartmentalization. The integrity of the Halachic system is sacrosanct. Yeah. Absolutely not. That's absolutely correct. And I, as a practitioner, okay, I'll tell you something. I do history of halacha. That's what I do, among other things. Absolutely. For two reasons. First of all, because of violation of the integrity of halacha. Second of all, for another reason. As a practitioner, I can tell you that I, perhaps more than anybody else, am very much aware of the limitations of academic method. Scientific method, especially, they use this in evolution, I don't want to deal with that here. In the humanities and the social sciences, there is no more conditional, tentative enterprise than the social sciences and the humanities. I have seen the consensus on dozens and dozens and dozens of issues flip from one extreme to the other in my lifetime, and I've only been at it for 34 years. Okay? So what am I going to do? So today I'm going to change, overthrow this psak halacha, because today this is what it looks like. Tomorrow it certainly, academically will turn it around and come up something else. So it's not only a violation of the integrity of the Torah, which a person of faith shouldn't do, it's also bad halacha. It's also bad history. Okay, one of the things I'm always amazed at, and I don't know why this is true, the academics should be, my colleagues should be the most modest and humble and deferential of people, and my experience has been different. Okay? As I've gone on, I mean, I feel dumber and dumber as time has gone on, and they seem to know, be more and more dogmatic. But I've discovered that academic, dogmatic religious person in the world. Okay, since we're coming up to the end, so that's the question of the integrity of the system. I want to make one last point. The great problem of halacha since 425 CE has been the lack of authority. With the abolition of the patriarchate, at least, with the abolition of the patriarchate by the Romans, by the Byzantines, there has been no central authority that determines halacha for everyone. So then the question always becomes, how do you know what to do? And the bottom line has become consensus. Take a look at the Gemara number source number 7 is the Gemara Sanhedrin Daf Lamed Gimel Amud Aleph. The Amar Rav Sheshi Amar Rav Ashi. This is a famous sugya that it's actually very popular in Williamsburg. The Satmar Yeshivas, they love to. There are certain specific sugyas they spend their whole lives on. This is one of them. It's the sugya of Midbar Mishnah. Midbar Mishnah Chozer. If a judge made a mistake about an open and obvious ruling, then that overturns that reverses the judgment. Tabishikul Adas. If he made a mistake as far as in adjudicating it, where there's no obvious answer, Eino Chozer, then the judgment stays. What's it called? Stare Decisis? Yeah, Stare Decisis. Thank you. Amale Ravina Ravashi. So, wait a minute. He says, what's Dvar Mishnah? Where do you have like something which is accepted by everybody? He says, Afilu ta be Rabbi Yechia be Rabbi Yoshia and the generation after the Mishnah, Amarlo in Vafilu be Rabbi Shmuel, even regarding something that was said in the next generation of Amorayim, of the first generation of Amorayim in Babel, Amarlo in Afilu be Didiu be Didach, even you and me, Amarle Atuan and Katli Kanabagmana, what are we? We're schleppers. We're guys that go in the pond and hawk reeds. Obviously, every generation can add and create another level, another dimension of psak, which can become binding, or can overturn earlier opinions. Says the Gemara, okay, that's that a later generation become Dvar Mishnah and as binding as the Mishnah, we've understood. Hechi dami shikul adas, what do you mean if you've made a mistake in adjudicating? Amarav pape, kigon trei tanoyu trei amaroi de pligia hadade. Velo itmar hilchas alokimar velo kimar. Veikri vavet kad minayhu, vesugi de shmaitz ali ki ida chani shikul adas. That there's no open and shut decision on a specific issue. And he decides one way, and most, Rashi says, courts, the consensus go the other way. So in that case you say stare decisis. That principle of sugi d'shmaitza, of consensus over time, is the operating factor. The Rama says this in Shulchan Aruch and Simen Kaf Hein Choshen Mishpat, Sif Beis. That becomes the operative factor of how do you know what the regnant psak is in a given generation. Now, can that change? It can absolutely change. However, towards that end, again, we don't have all this time, take a look at number, at the rush at the bottom. Vehecha, this is the, quotes the rush. Vehecha shenechleku k'shnei gedolim b'psak halacha. Okay, you have an open moot question among major authorities. Lo yomar hadayin efso k'misha erze. Says, I'm going to arbitrarily decide based on what I want. If you do it arbitrarily, then that's absolutely it's a false judgment. If he is an accomplished scholar, not a guy just with smicha out of yeshiva, or even the head of a program, gamir v'savir, he has the ability to be able to independently adjudicate a broad analyze. And he knows how to determine to make a decision between the two sides. Kedivri ha'echad b'rayos b'ros n'chochos. He can cogently and convincingly render an opinion one's way or the other. Harishus biado. But you have to be qualified, and you have to be able to back it up. It's not a matter of like the Rambam. The Rambam says you're not allowed to say this is true just because so-and-so said so. So-and-so is a big shot. Very nice. That is a violation of the Torah, says Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, because it says, Lo tisa p'nei dal v'lo te'adar p'nei gadol. You shouldn't show favoritism either to poor people or to rich people. You have to be on point. V'afilu im pasak chacham echad bin yayacher. Yochel ha-chacham listar dvor b'rayos v'lachlok alav. Certainly, if he is qualified, he has that right. But the Ravid in an earlier part of this passage says, but to overcome a consensus, that requires serious discussion, and that is not, that's a rarity. Now, what do you mean a rarity? There are things like that, and it does happen, but it happens over time. And towards that end, I'd like to share with you number 8. This is about 5 years ago, Ravon Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, consented to Reb Chaim Sabato's interviewing him on a whole broad range of issues. It's a wonderful book. The book is called Mevakshei Panecha. The book, I think it's actually, is it appeared yet, or it's certainly about to be prepared. Okay, sorry. The truth of the matter is, if you can read it in Hebrew, read it in Hebrew, because there's nobody who writes like Rav Chaim Sabato. So, I mean, that's by itself. But if you can't, if the Hebrew is hard, so get the English. Among the things he discusses is feminism. And he was asked by Rav Chaim Sabato, after he goes on and says how important it is for women to learn Torah at the highest level. And in fact, he took the Rav's initiative. Don't forget, the Rav gave the first shiur at Stern in Gemara. Okay? You don't forget that. He never backed off from that. And anybody tells you otherwise doesn't know what he's talking about. And I know that for a fact. And Bavar took it even further. Because he was behind the creation of Migdal Oz, which his daughter is in charge of. I think he was officially the rector of Michlaot and Migdal Oz. So, he writes as follows. On the question of what will be the implications towards the function of women in the Orthodox community, what is the role of these learned women, he says as follows. Yesh sikunim mesuyamim. There are dangers. Anachnu chayim b'chlal b'dinamit. We live in a dynamic culture. B'tkufa dinamit. Aval davka b'glal shezeh dinami, tzarich lizaher miliftor. Ol nesot liftor talichim shecholim lihyot marchikei lechet b'glulot. You can't just give a pill and we say in Hebrew, ein pitronot instant. There's no such thing as a quick fix. Tzarich ayin pekucha, yachol yot shiyu dvorim shiyera'u acheret. Shema, yesh gam tchumim acherim, mi lanu gadol kemo Rav Kook, shekol hatzibur dati shelanu mekabel oto v'ohed oto. He favors him, admires him. Hu lo haya mukhan lahatir ma shekol charedi hayom metir. Kol gedolei acheridim hayom omrim shenashim yarutzu latzbiya bekalpi. Omnam, okay? But Rav Kook was dead set against, now women shouldn't vote and they shouldn't be elected. It's a violation of the sanctity of the family. Omnam, ein he mukhanim shehitiyem memuneh, then yen shel shitot vishonim, he's already go into it. Things change. But it's the pace of the change which he wants to emphasize. And now he comes to his conclusion. Eini yodea, now watch the way he says this. Eini yodea ma yifseku poskei hador ba'od 30 shana b'sheilot samchut nashim v'chadomeh. By the way, on this issue in terms of women rabbis, women in positions of authority, I call your attention to an article by Rav Lichtenstein, which appeared in the latest issue of A Tradition. It's available on rabbis.org on the front slide. Ein li musag, but notice he says 30 years. Eineni ba lenabe tachziyot. Ani lo kol kach mishuchna kemo sharbe nashim choshvot kemo sheisha hazo sheratzta lichta, so and so forth. Skip this. He says, I know this. The Rambam is the issue and so on. However, avali mashani ken yodea zashayom chashuv shebenot Yisrael teidana Torah shetiyena dveikot b'Torah legabe kol shar eini yodea omer b'diyuk b'hadi kivshi derachmano lamali. I don't know what God has planned. There are a number of presuppositions that lie behind this paragraph, which will allow me to pull together the points I wanted to make. Point number one, that ultimately you're dealing in a divine system, and there's no such thing as rushing in and changing things roughly. Okay? Number one. Number two. The people who are to make the changes have to be, as the Rosh says, Gomir v'Savir Gedolei Chachamim. The revolution of women's Torah study would not have happened had it not been backed first by the Chafetz Chaim and by the Ger Rebbe, as far as schools are concerned, and as far as Gemara is concerned, by the Rav, because the Rav could not be dismissed. Okay, that's number two. Three, and this is something which I think we have to keep in mind. When a faith community is challenged to go places it has not yet gone, It has to do it according to its own pace and the rules by which it lives, which generally means it goes more slowly, and also the results will not look like what the outside world is demanding or challenging. It will be adaptive on its own terms. So somebody recently said, yes, you know, the Orthodox always come up 45 years later to do exactly what conservative reform do. No. The question of bat mitzvah, for example, is a mistake in an article that appeared in the same series that I participated in. The idea that there should be a ceremony for a girl who comes into majority was a novelty. It took time for it to be able to develop, but it developed in terms that the Torah, and was lit in the terms that the Torah could accommodate, that reflected the eternal values that can be traced all the way back with authority and with responsibility, and not beyond that. The process of influence, everybody's influenced. But the question of influence from the outside is a question not so much of being influenced as to what is accepted and what is rejected. And what in that which is accepted in, how is it modified to adapt it to what I hold to be sacred? Because what I hold to be sacred is determined upon the Torah which I hold to be sacred, because the being who gave it to us is sacred. Thank you very much.
Good question.